than Orla nor V had spent there. According to Morn, it was, for the most part, your typical large city, a scab of nobles, wealthy merchants, and shipping tycoons crusted over a great messy wound of laborers and peons. The difference was Dolendon was literally split down the middle, Norren to the eastern shore, and humans to the western, and the only Norren allowed to cross westward were slaves. In other words, some tenth of the total populace of Dolendon, a figure Blaze found incredulous, why don't they just flex their biceps, pop their bonds, and start smashing skulls? And Dante found dubious. With that many slaves running around, how could you tell which Norren on the western shore were owned and which ones were free? Morn explained. Slaves were branded on their right cheeks. All Norren citizens were lawfully obligated to restrict their beards to an inch in length so the slaves couldn't comb them over their brands. Any Norren man with a longer beard could be arrested on sight and, in the best-case scenario, deported to the eastern banks. Permits were allocated to allow Norren leaders, traders, and diplomats to handle their business on the human side, but there were never more than a few dozen permits active at any one time, and even the permanent ones, most were day passes, had to be renewed annually at a steep fee. And yes, Free Norren had tried to thwart this system by branding themselves, wandering the western shore, and passing as slaves out on the errands of their masters, but all brands were registered at the chattelry office. Meanwhile, Norren sporting unknown brands were eligible to be captured and held in the officers' cells, and if they weren't claimed within a month, at the cost of a claimant fee and, naturally, a second fee for the registry of one's brand, to be auctioned at the monthly market to the benefit of Dolendon's coffers. In short, challenge the system at the risk of your eternal freedom. Other than being regularly invaded by chattelry office agents in pursuit of escaped slaves, the Eastern Shore was essentially left to its own affairs, however, meaning it bore but a superficial resemblance to the standard human sprawl of urban trade, labor, appointed officers, and law enforcement. Rulers were determined through typical Norren process, that is, their murky theophilosophical sparring grounds. But East Dolendon was special among Norren cities in that it was the only one to be truly massive in the way Setevan was massive, or Bressel, or, of late, Narashtivik itself. This allowed for a phenomenon unique among all Norren territories, and thus probably the world. The Nulladun.
"Oh, come on, you can't just stop there," Blaze frowned. "You wouldn't be telling us if it wasn't important."
"It would take too long to explain," Morn said.
"We won't reach Dolendon for nearly a day."
"That's what I just said."
"Then be brief," Dante said. "It might be important." Morn screwed up his face.
"It's like a game of dice."
"That doesn't sound that involved."
"That runs the city. And instead of the exchange of money, it determines the exchange of items and nulla."
Blaze glanced away from the grassy riverbanks.
"Nulla?
How can I explain the Nulladun if you don't even know?"
Morn interrupted himself to sigh, and leaned his heavy arms upon the boomer's railing.
"It means craft favors. IOUs, sort of, but instead of money, it can be whatever the Norren making the promise is famous for. Swords, tapestries, dances."
"Dances?"
"I told you, it's complicated."
Even this bare attempt to summarize the Nulladun put Morn into one of his moods. Dante had spent enough time in the territories to know what nulla were, but he had little inclination to attempt to wheedle, cajole, or flatter Morn into explaining exactly what the Nulladun was, particularly when below decks smelled like bandaged blood and infection, evidence of nearly a dozen wounded warriors suffering from everything from scrapes and bruises to deep sword wounds and one broken arm. By the time Dante finished treating them, the warrior's arm was free of its sling. Stitches were trimmed from sashed arms and bellies, sweaty brows cooled and relaxed. If it came down to it, he expected each one could lift a sword by the time they debarked in Dolendun. The lead-up to their arrival was an uneventful passage of forested shorelines. Through the bare branches, metal clanged and axes chunked. After the frost, bitter winds and shadowed pockets of snow on their long descent from the hills, the hard, cool sunlight of Dolendun felt like a tepid relief. So, too, did the return to a proper city, even a foreign one. Docks choked the river on both its east and west, and the smoke of countless chimneys mingled into a single cloud above the river. But otherwise, the shores of Dolendun looked like two different countries. On the west, wood cottages sprouted on the outskirts, often built right onto the walls of pre-existing houses. Past a high stone defensive wall, the buildings leapt to 3 and 4 stories in height, crowned by the high, snow-shedding peaks typical of Gascon construction. Houses stood wall to wall, so straight and narrow, an arrow shot through one window might well pass straight through another on the far side. Except on the hastiest houses, those that leaned like beer-blinded longshoremen. The windows were ovals, ringed by dark wood that stood out from the blonde pinewood walls and occasional splash of whitewash. 3 hills stood at a reproachful distance from the urban crush, lush green courtyards visible between round-towered manors of clean white limestone. There were no such manors on the eastern side. No defensive walls, either. In fact, there appeared to be very little of stone at all, aside from some homes dug straight into the sides of the hills. Rather than cottages and shacks, the space between the surrounding meadows and the city proper consisted of tents, yurts, and other nomadic repositories. Sophisticated multi-family shelters with patterns and illustrations stitched into their oiled leather sides mixed with the crudest of pine-branch lean-tos. Further in, the round-windowed wooden houses rarely rose above 2 stories. "Hey, Morn, your people's side looks like shit," Blaze said. The skin crinkled around Morn's bovine eyes.
"Hey, Blaze, your people's side looks like it uses the people from my side as beasts of burden."
"I'm not criticizing."
"Well, I am."
Varlin and crew guided the boomer to a dock big enough to tie the barge up. The clan had all but completely unloaded their gear by the time Dante finished re-explaining the situation to the stout captain, who was affronted that Dante couldn't be more specific about how long they'd spend in town than a day or several. The river smelled of sewage and mud, sludgy vegetables, and used cooking oil. To preserve the ruse, they were a common barley barge with the usual assortment of random passengers. Dante stayed on board along with Blaze, Morn, Lyra, and Gala, who stood just under 6.5 feet tall, practically a dwarf by Norrin standards. Despite her stony muscles, she was almost thin, too. With the rest of the clan of the Nine Pines departing through the streets to camp out on the edges of town, the boomer shoved off, tacking across the river to tie up at another dock and discharge its remaining passengers. Dante and crew donned hooded winter cloaks and descended the pier to the streets of western Dolendun. The city was, at a glance, no different from all major cities. Men and women rushed along with a haste that seemed absurdly self-important to the outside eye, particularly when most of them were probably on their way to hold foolish discussions over too much tea, or to broker business deals they would regret the moment they lay down to sleep. It was the sort of jostling, steaming hustle that exasperates everyone involved, leading to behavior that ranges from the annoying, people slinging elbows, carriage wheels throwing mud, what self-important pricks, to the potentially lethal, the reckless, wild-eyed speed of the horse teams, who could easily crush a man if he didn't hear the driver's shouts, and who drove as if arriving 30 seconds early to their appointments would make the difference between laughing from the castle's roof and dying in the shit-caked gutters. Annoying or outright dangerous, these conditions struck Dante with equal irritation. Dollondon was, in short, exactly the same and exactly as different as every big city in the world. It was unique in its particular blend of spices, smoke, and waste. It was identical in its bustle, the urban pace someone from nowhere would dismiss as a fine place to visit but not live, while visitors from other big cities would peg as interesting, in its own quaint way, but not half so much as wherever they were from. In Dante's case, it wasn't as large as Bressel, or as historically, almost mythically charged as Narashtovic. Still, it was a city in the way all non-cities aren't, and he breathed the air as if it were the vapors of a cleansing tonic, observing shops and citizens as if they held secrets he'd never uncover. By the time Blaise selected an inn, entirely at random, Dante was already regretting a departure which would inevitably come too soon. The three-story structure's eaves and cornices were heavy with elaborate Gascon Old Empire leaf carvings, but the inside was drafty and stained, perfect for maintaining appearances on a limited budget. Dante and Blaise got pleasantly drunk, which is what one does in new cities, particularly when plying locals and regular passers-by for information, but learned nothing revelatory about Peregrin the beefer, other than that he resented the slang term for his profession, and that he lived on Soundon Hill. Dante woke with the sun nearly full overhead. His mouth tasted like soured beer. Morn watched reproachfully from the common room, munching on bread and celery. Dante dispatched a letter of introduction to one of the messengers trotting up and down the boardwalks, then returned upstairs to wake Blaise, a task every bit as dangerous as wandering into a pirate's ambush. Their subterfuge was simple. They'd pose as Malish aristocrats resettled in Gask, in the hopes of trebling their fortunes shipping tea from the valleys of Galador to the busy southern ports. All they needed was labor, which they'd heard the Norren provided in spades. Peregrin replied via messenger that evening for a meet on the following day. "It's been so long since we've been somewhere proper," Blaise said that night, as if he'd needed a full day to absorb the shift from windswept grass and birded hills to bustling city. "The clan won't mind if we dawdle on their cousins, will they? What's 3 more days in chains to people who expect to spend their whole lives in them?" Morn gazed over the foamy tower of his beer.
"If V heard you, she'd split you like a log. Not a log she liked, either."
"Well, V's not here, is she?" "I'm making a decision in my capacity as leader." Dante glanced at Gala, who hadn't said 4 words since they'd stepped onto the docks. "I declare this beer is for enjoying, not arguing. We'll see what happens tomorrow." Beyond the greasy oval windows, wagons hauled grain and clay and stone and hay to the houses on the hills. The carriage arrived on schedule the following noon. Morn and Gala held the doors while Dante and Blaise seated themselves on the hardwood bench. The Norren gave slight bows, then circled to the back of the carriage and stepped onto the running boards. The vehicle's body groaned and lowered under their weight. "Why can't they sit in here?" Dante said. Blaise peered at him from the corners of his eyes. "Because they'd squish us to death?" "Oh yes, and their slaves." It was rhetorical. Out the screened window, humans came and went, hopping over piles of horseshit and stopping outside the tea-houses to snag passing friends by the collars and grin in their faces. Around them, silent, stooped men carried sacks and letters, faces grim and grimy. Norren strode on errands, too, bearded lighthouses among the sea of humans.
the giant's cheeks were cut close or shaved bald, showing tiny pink lines, letters, and simple icons. The carriage swung uphill. Gala and Morn stepped down to trot along behind. A paper fluttered from a high window. In a narrow gap between houses, a Norrin sat in the mud, clutching his bloody face. The road leveled out. The crush of structures cleared out in favor of wide lawns, green shoots pushing past the brown of winter. Dante pressed against the carriage door as the driver swung onto a cobbled road. Ahead, the pavement reeled straight toward a white stone manor that could have served as the keep of some towns. Whip-thin trees lined the path and the house's front, their branches blue-green and needly. A bald man in outdated formal wear received them in the echoing foyer. Morn and Gala were seen to the servants' quarters. Sunlight gushed through the windows, illuminating swirling dust motes. Two fires snapped in the manor's central hall. Dante accepted a padded red seat in front of one hearth, where he warmed his hands and gazed across the wall tapestries, stitched portraits of middle-aged men, most of whom showed grass-green eyes and regally aquiline noses. Their beards were a timeline of high Gascon style, trim, pointed triangles, then aggressive, full-faced snarls that would have driven off a bear. Finally, the cut of the previous generation, square sideburns, which continued perpendicular from the earlobe to connect to a straight, manicured moustache. "Warm enough?" Behind them, a tall, green-eyed man clicked across the stone, his padded coat clinging smartly to his chest. His coat was green as his eyes, and divided into neat squares by glossy black stitching. Dante rose. "Lord Peregrine."
"Lords Winslow and Lionstones,"
he greeted Dante and Blaze in turn. Dante quashed his frown at the names Blaze had given them.
"I'm honored you took to me on your expansion to Gask."
"The loftiness of your reputation competes with the peaks of the Junholes," Blaze said, entirely straight-faced.
Talk turned for some minutes to the common ground of all wealthy strangers, whether they enjoyed their trip, had they yet been to Dolandun's frozen gardens, the short-sighted taxation policies of their respective rulers. Peregrine's self-deprecating discourse on the nature of success in business, which he compared to a blind shepherd repeatedly driving his flock off a cliff, then crowing in triumph after one of his fallen sheep broke open a vein of gold, was charming enough that Dante temporarily forgot the lord had built that fortune on the literal backs, as well as hands, legs, and sinews, of hundreds, if not thousands, of Norrin slaves.
15 or 20,
Blaze said once the topic finally turned to their own business, specifically the number of laborers their tea-growing operation would require. Peregrine raised his thin black eyebrows.
"Then you hardly need even my modest expertise. You could fill that order at the back market on your way home."
"That's just for the initial outlay," Blaze said. "It's all about feasibility, you know. The sustainability of the strategy. We could wait for another 3 or 5 years and plunge whole barrel into the operation, but who knows how diluted the market will look then, you know. Whereas if we start now, well, the leverage cranks itself."
"Of course." "In which case we'll need a regular supply of bodies," Dante said. Peregrine gazed across the faces of his ancestors on the wall tapestries.
"Strong backs are always in demand, of course, but we may be able to arrange an annual contract."
"Not all of our investors are as confident as we are. We were hoping to make a strong initial splash."
"Nothing opens a man's eyes like having water dashed in his face," Blaze added. "We heard you were in possession of the entire clan of the Green Lake."
"Ah."
The man leaned back in his padded chair, smoothing his rich green coat.
"Fearsome warriors. Their plowshares are as fierce as their swords."
"So you have them," Dante said.
"No."
Dante's face fell.
Do you know who does?
Naturally. I'm the one who sold them.
We were hoping to make the buyer an offer. With workers such as those,
I'm afraid not.
Peregrine cut in with a regretful smile. Let's leave it at that.
We're all gentlemen here.
Blaze drew back his head, shoulders straightened.
Surely we can make a gentleman's agreement not to tell any other men, gentle or otherwise, that the name of a certain other gentleman was disclosed here?
It's easy enough to earn money. Much harder yet to earn a reputation. I bank on my integrity more deeply than any credit. The deal was made in private, and there it must remain.
There must be some arrangement we can make, Dante said, thinking quickly. We're not just men of business. We're men who make things happen.
Oh, no doubt. So when I say the matter is closed, it is with trepidatious hope you do not use those powers to do against me.
Along the walls, the eyes of the tapestries swung to focus on Peregrine. Their gazes grew steely, glaring. Beards bunched as jowls soured into frowns and sneers. Their lips began to move, muttering silent condemnations, the dark rhythms of curses. The movement caught Peregrine's eye. He did a double take, staring expressionlessly at the displeasure of his ancestors, their shaking heads and curled lips.
Like that, they stopped, once more still stitching, hanging from the wall.
You don't see that every day, Blaze improvised. How often do all your relatives agree on anything?
The last wisps of nether fell from Dante's grasp. That depends on who is convincing them.
To Peregrine's credit, he met Dante's eyes, his cheeks and brows showing mere hints of strain.
What is this supposed to prove?
Blaze smiled. How crummy your afterlife would be if you suddenly joined them.
It's not a threat, Dante said, just a display of the powers we could put at your disposal.
I am a wealthy man.
Peregrine smoothed his mustache, and with it his face. He gestured to the high stone walls, the snapping fires, and finally the tapestries, where his gaze lingered, hardening into a resentful scowl.
My face isn't beside my ancestors. That's because the only one worthy of capturing my likeness to hang along my forefathers refuses to do so on account of the grounds by which I made the wealth that would pay her.
Her name is Waring. She lives on the east side.
And if we acquire her servers, Dante said, you will also acquire the buyer's name.
The departure was as chilly as the air outside the manor. A servant closed the groaning doors.
You know, we could just ask one of them.
Blaze gestured toward the servant.
They'll usually respond to beatings.
Dante buttoned his coat to the collar. The few who know would probably be killed for speaking.
Let's see Waring and see what happens.
Their carriage waited. As Dante piled in, Moore leaned in to the Norrin driver and exchanged a few words. The horses trotted down the path, wheels grinding loose pebbles. From the hilltop, Dolendun stretched for miles, bifurcated by the silvery band of the river. The carriage swung a sudden left down an alley of tight-packed houses and descended another hill into a wide plaza of packed dirt and trampled grass. At the square's fringes, humans jabbered to each other, scribbling notes, exchanging them, frowning, and then scribbling a fresh note, often to the exact same reaction. Behind them, Norrin crouched in cages of thick wood and pitted metal. Many were half-naked, others shoeless. A fat man lumbered forward, leaning against the weight of the bucket hanging from his hand. Water splashed over his shoes. He slopped the bucket across the floor of one cage, rinsing waste onto the muddy ground, then turned and waddled back toward the fountain at the plaza's center. Men in padded cotton coats milled about the grounds, pausing in front of occupied cages. Then, with their hands on their hips or chins, they appraised the captive subjects from tip to toes. Equally well-dressed sellers approached to point out abundances of muscles and teeth. As their carriage cornered down another alley, an eye-patched man, accompanied by two others brandishing spears, swung open the bars of a cage and shouted its occupants into the sunlight. Blaze, who rarely stopped talking even after years of travel together, didn't speak until the carriage wheels clicked onto the mortared stone of the bridge. The eastern shorefront was a profusion of shops, warehouses, and public houses, from whose open windows wafted spiced tea and spicier tobaccos. Dante called a stop outside a shop with a carving of a loom above its door and rugs piled in its windows. Morn hopped down and went inside while Gala watched the street, sword on her back. Morn emerged a minute later and fed the driver directions to Warring's. Her shop stood in the middle of a cockeyed street so narrow they had to debark the carriage and continue on foot. The building's squarish design, slightly flared at the top, suggested it had once been a yurt, long since plastered over with timber, and its cramped, dark interior only confirmed that. The close air was heavy with the smell of soap and dried linen. Dante seated himself on a bench a few inches too high, where he was joined by Blaze and Morn, and kicked his heels. Between the three of them, there was scarcely space to turn around. Though Dante had spent little time in Narashtavik in the last few years, and littler time yet attending to the ceremonial and social sides of his post as one of the 12-person council there, he'd nonetheless acted as a man about town on more than one occasion. Often enough to think Waring's shop was all wrong for her apparent stature. The floors of finest artists and craftsmen were supposed to be open and airy, intentional wastes of space, which called all the more attention to the sparse examples of their work on display, and thus how valuable these few pieces must be. By contrast, Waring's main floor was a crush of raw fabric, loose threads, and steel needles, the unfinished materials lumped in piles around the finished work. Work that more than justified the urgency of Peregrine's vain request. Most of Waring's tapestries showed landscapes and cityscapes, misty hills, dignified white row houses, and the primarily civilized hill homes of the Norrin. A minority displayed the faces of human men and women, most in three-quarter or full profile, but a few straight on. Their gazes, so superior and regal, they made Dante feel as if he'd loudly farted. Yet there was a softness to their eyes, too, a mitigating light that suggested all was forgiven, that we are, after all human, even those of us whose blood runs blue as the sky. This liveliness was shared by the landscapes and cityscapes. When Dante glanced away, or an unseen draft ruffled the room, the rivers and lamps and stars twinkled. In short, they were amazing. He had half a mind to hire Waring services for himself. After the clearing of a throat or two, a thin Norrin woman emerged from the back room. At 6 feet tall, her brown eyes were nearly level with Dante's, or at least as close as he had ever come on a Norrin. Her bare arms could easily pass for human as well, though one that got plenty of exercise, say, a water carrier or a widow who'd taken charge of her late husband's farm. She indicated her three guests. Her hands were as swift and precise as a professional swordsman's. "I know why you're here." She seated herself behind her cluttered desk. "You want me to build you an airship?" Dante blinked. "We're here about a tapestry." "Well, you're obviously not here for the jokes. I can spare 5 minutes, please don't waste them." He launched into an extremely abbreviated version of what had brought them to her. The woman cut him off as soon as he got to Peregrine's name.
Absolutely not.
I don't think you understand. Dante glanced toward the closed door, as if spies might have their waggling ears pressed to the other side. If we do this for him, he will give us the location of an entire clan of slaves, slaves which, if we have our druthers, won't be slaves for long.
Then beat it out of him.
That's what I suggested, Blaze said.
This is true, Dante said. It's much easier to wrest dozens of unwilling captives from their baronial owner when you're arrested or dead.
Waring's brown eyes didn't sway from his.
You're not going to guilt me into this. You know what Peregrine does. The only work I'll ever do for him will be sawn from his own hide.
Dante sighed inwardly, wishing he had the power to annihilate the entire kingdom of Gask, Norrin territories and himself included, and thus avoid another single moment of this self-defeating nonsense.
I know the perspective must be very skewed from a horse that high, but I'm trying to help.
And I'd help you if I could. But immortalizing that man would violate every principled bone in my body. Unfortunately for you, that's all of them.
Well, Dante rose, feeling like he weighed 1,000 pounds.
Your work is exceptional.
He left to meet Gala in the crooked alley. Blaze glanced back at the shop.
Is it time to go beat a nobleman?
The idea was tempting as a basement-cooled beer after a long day, but Dante shook his head.
That's our last resort.
I didn't realize we had any other resorts.
Moon, I need you to tell me more about the Nulla Dune.
Gala, I need you to find out to what extent Waring participates in it.
It's a little like chess, Moon said.
Gala shook her head. More like hearts. Or pluck.
I was getting to that.
I thought you said it was like dice, Dante said.
That too.
Morn tipped back his head and considered the high, patchy clouds.
It also resembles an argument.
An argument? Blaze said. How's that?
Mostly because it is one.
Dante exhaled audibly.
I think I need to see this. Is there somewhere we can sit down and play around?
Morn shrugged his broad shoulders. Oh, just anywhere.
The Norrin man gave Gala the name of a public house and directions to it. She nodded and strode down the alley. Morn led them toward the docks. Baked vegetables and potatoes steamed from vendors' stalls, tickled with herbs from all over. At a thoroughfare, Norrin drove mule teams or simply hauled the wagons themselves, leaning into leather straps tied to flatbeds, bearing bricks or chopped wood or burlap sacks. About 1 out of 10 women showed brands on their cheek. Morn led them into a busy tavern with 2 leaping salmon painted above its door. Inside, Norrin partook in the standard drinking, laughing, gossiping, and news-chasing, but an unusual number of the crowd were gathered at the back, peering over the shoulders of 3 men seated at a wide table. Blaze bought pints, Morn went to speak to the bartender, and came back with a set of battered wooden cases. Dante sipped beer, cold as the street and just as bitter.
Nulla Dune, Morn said, unprompted. First, you have a board.
Well, that sounds easy enough, Blaze said.
Most things do when you've no idea what you're talking about.
Morn rubbed the thin strip of bare skin between his brows and hairline.
Sorry, I'm under a lot of stress here. There are classical map arrangements some players specialize in, but you can arrange your tiles freeform, too, with opponents taking turns until the map's complete. Pieces are affected by elevation and water and so forth.
He unsnapped the hasps of one case and found out a handful of flat wooden squares, mostly painted blue or green. From a second case, he drew several wooden figures, worn and chipped but still identifiable as archers and spearmen and scouts.
Then they are your pieces. Like chess, they all move and attack in their own ways, but they can do other things too.
Morn pulled the twine from a deck of cards and spread them out. Dante didn't recognize a single one.
Then you have your cards. Your opponent does too. You both have cards. Cards affect units and conditions like weather, and you can use them to provoke your opponent into using, losing, or giving you some of his cards. Think of them like ploys, battlefield gambits.
He stared at the array of equipment. Dante picked up the cards and leafed through them.
Where does the argument come in?
Everywhere. Morn sighed. Each turn also involves an ongoing philotheosophical debate. Like the maps, there can be classic topics or decided on by the players. The soundness and originality of your argument influence play similarly to the cards.
You're just making this up, aren't you? Blaze said. Arguments? So after you've shouted at each other for a bit, the other guy's just going to say, "Oh, good point, here's my king."
The merits of each player's arguments are decided by 1 to 3 arbiters. If the argument's that good or that bad, the spectators weigh in. A biased arbiter won't stay biased for long, not unless he enjoys black eyes.
Morn glanced to the back of the room, where men roared with abrupt and unified triumph. Once it quieted, he went on.
Victory is achieved through wiping the other guy out or forcing him to concede. The winner collects his nulla, the terms of which are decided before the match.
Dante looked up from a carving of a fanged, long-nosed beast.
That's the idea. All I have to do is beat Waring in a match. Perrigan gets his tapestry, we get our name.
Before we get any deeper, I think we should talk about something, Blaze said. Like, what the hell this has to do with why we're here?
Morn clicked the tiles against the table.
It's a good plan. It's also a very bad plan.
Start with the good.
If Waring plays, and they all do, she'll abide by her debts.
Blaze quirked his mouth with doubt. She'll break her personal rule about no dealing with abominable slave drivers to stick by the rules of some game?
Yes, Morn said. And if that doesn't do it, the threat of fines, beatings, and in extreme cases enslavement should convince her instead.
So, what's the bad? Dante said.
You can't possibly win.
Of course I can.
How long have you been playing Nulla Dune?
Well, never.
Morn gestured to the spread of pieces, cards, and tiles.
Never. You've been playing for never. Which is funny, because most of this city's been playing since always. Since they were kids.
Big deal, Blaze nodded. We can just cheat.
Morn went as still as one of the wooden units.
You can't cheat at Nulla Dune.
I can cheat at anything. I'll cheat you right now if you want. What would you like to be cheated at?
It's sacred. It's not something you do.
Dante leaned in, matching the low tones of the Norran man, if not his awed disgust.
Morn, what does it matter? We're talking about saving your cousin's lives. Is that less important than the rules of a game?
The Norn exhaled until his whole body slumped like a discarded shirt.
I don't like this.
Me neither, Blaze says. It's more tangled up than spiders playing tag.
Dante reached for his beer.
If you can think of a better way, I'm all ears.
I can think of 20.
That doesn't involve punching, stabbing, or us being jailed.
I can't think of any.
Dante took a long drink to hide his smile. He couldn't think of anything less convoluted either, but in point of fact, he wanted to play. He'd been allured by the Nulla Dune from the moment Morn mentioned it, and hearing its rough details had hooked him all the harder. It was clearly a game you could get lost in, endlessly variable, with strategies within strategies, all of which might be compromised or annihilated by the wrong stroke of luck,
leaving you angry, yet determined, obsessed to play again, and prove that, when the game is fair, you cannot be beat.
He looked forward to studying its facets and depths with an intellectual eagerness he hadn't felt since discovering the cycle of Aron. After several complaints he was hardly an expert, Morn relented and agreed to teach him. Morn arranged the map in one of its simplest variants, led Dante through a quick overview of piece selection, just as customizable as the maps, then proceeded through what he warned was a dumbed-down game. Though it was clearly an expository match, with Morn constantly pausing to explain a rule and its limitless permutations, exceptions, and contingencies, it nonetheless drew a steady stream of onlookers, many who seemed as interested in the fact a human was learning their game as in the outcome of the halting match itself. Morn had no trouble enlisting a trio to arbitrate the scoring of their debates.
And those were the stumbling blocks. Dante grasped the core combat at once, a rock-paper-scissors-style system of engagement with just enough intrinsic complexity to allow for in-depth strategy in every situation. By their second game, several of his gambits drew appreciative nods and chuckles from the crowd. Yet each skirmish, every single goddamn one, resulted in the loss of a unit, territory, or both, overcome by modifiers from Morn's cards, or his victories in debate.
Dante simply didn't know enough. He knew most of the key players, Joson Joe and his host of brothers, cousins, and enemies, and when it came to philosophical concepts, he was easily Morn's better. Yet he didn't know enough of Noran Theosophy to marry the general to the specific. It was beyond frustrating.
Gala returned in the middle of their third match. "She plays."
"Finally, some good luck," Blaze said.
"Not really. They all play."
"Told you," Morn said.
He advanced his swordsman. After a brief exchange of modifiers, Dante removed his ice drake from the board. After his third loss, Dante dropped from his oversized seat to go update Orlin on their situation. Gala had arranged a note drop under one of the piers, and warn him it could be days or even weeks before they moved on. He penned a letter of aid to Peregrine, too, alerting him Dante believed they'd secure his tapestries soon enough, but that he'd first need access to as many libraries of Noran lore as Peregrine could get him into. He resumed play. Morn's style was plodding and defensive, advancing his pieces with stubborn deliberance until his advantage was too overwhelming to break. His style of debate mirrored it, carefully laying the groundwork and initial conditions. That history showed Joson Joe was in Canwell on the third day of the third year, before unleashing his conclusions in an ironclad case, and thus couldn't have been the father of Kandak, whose mother had, on the day of the boy's conception, been across the land in Meriden. Dante tried a range of guiding strategies before settling on his standard, a deceptive style that appeared cautious yet relied on massive risks taken right under Morn's oversized nose. These efforts panned out often enough to turn the tables more than once, but by the time the two of them were too tired to go on, Dante still hadn't won a single match. Letters of recommendation arrived from Peregrine the next day. Dante split time between the two banks of the river, playing Nolladun in the east and reading Noran scripture in the west. On the third day of play, Dante retreated his main force to a steep hill, leaving a contingent of swift, light-hitting drakes trapped behind Morn's infantry wall, doomed before the next turn. But during that turn's debate, Dante tricked Morn into a confession that the traditional sacrifices to stall Pharaoh's wrath weren't rams, they were deer. Using that as a hinge for his conclusion that Pharaoh's domain was not with herding nomads, but instead among wild hunters, Dante racked up enough conditionals to send his lone remaining swordsman into a berserk fury. Morn lost three units before the berserker fell, along with the center of his line. Peppered by Dante's hilltop archers, harassed and ensnared by the hit-and-run drakes, Morn removed the last of his pieces from the board four turns later. The audience applauded and whooped. Significant fun was made of Morn's loss to a scrawny human outlander. Morn's smile was as slow as his advance across the battlefield.
Good move, he said. Now why don't you play someone who actually knows what the units with the spiky things are called?
Dante slouched back in his chair, heart thudding. But I don't have any nulla to wager.
You're so dumb you'd probably forget what food is for, Blaze said. You're the best healer in town. Bet with that.
Despite the potential for humiliation at the hands of a human, when it came to Nulla Dûn, the standard Norran suspicion of outsiders evaporated altogether. Within minutes of announcing he was looking for a match, Dante had enough appointments to fill out the day. It wasn't simply the novelty factor, either. Word had somehow spread that he'd healed several members of the Clan of the Nine Pines after a ferocious battle, and that his healing Nulla could cure anything short of death itself. In a city as mean, pestilential, and backbreaking as Dolandon, challengers lined up like he were passing out free wine. He lost, of course. The first game was a war of attrition. He couldn't keep up with his white-haired foe's subtle modifiers and wily wisdom during disputes. He played his second game against a young woman, but the match collapsed in less than 20 minutes when Dante's opening charge, intending to attain an initial strength advantage he could then leverage murderously through strangulating conservatism, died on enemy spears. The third match lasted right until midnight, however, a back-and-forth tilt that saw him and his rival switch not just tactical but geographical position several times, a game of reversals and re-reversals so captivating that the pub's owner began to complain his patrons had forgotten how to drink. When Dante's final piece, a battered sorcerer, finally dropped, there were as many sighs as cheers. Dante's opponent, a middle-aged potter, immediately bought him 3 beers. But it didn't matter that he lost, except for the time he lost when winners cashed in their nulla writs and called him away to soothe a sister's pneumonia or heal a father's broken wrist. Dante didn't resent the lost time. He didn't need to become the best. Not after he figured out how he could cheat. While card play was a single dimension of the game, it could provide a big enough advantage to overcome many slips of tactics and strokes of poor luck. If Dante could see his opponent's hand, through his connection to a dead fly on the wall, say, or better yet, a lizard, something small enough to escape notice but which at least shared his basic senses, he could overwhelm that field of the game, flushing out his opponent's hand while strengthening his own, anticipating their movements and preparing his counter-moves in advance. In one private test with Morn, Blaze acting as a hapless arbiter, it worked so well it was nearly too obvious. They tried again, with Dante playing his cards with just enough deliberate mistakes and oversights to pass muster. He continued playing, reading, analyzing, discussing. He won his first competitive match, earning a minor nulla from a silversmith, which he cashed in for the forging of a unique Nulla Dûn piece, a thin, unimposing sorcerer, one outstretched hand painted with charcoal shadows. Gala poked into Waring's playing habits, learning the weaver participated in at least one match a week and sometimes binged for several straight days. It was absorbing, engrossing, addicting. Some part of him wanted to forget that quivering bow existed, to give up his very council seat in Narashtivik to continue matching wits in the smoky taverns of Dolodun's Norran shore. This was a fantasy, of course. Across town, the Clan of the Nine Pines waited in their tents. Somewhere in the heart of Gask, the Clan of the Green Lake waited in their chains. Within a week, he won as often as he lost. That achieved, he began to cheat. At first, a single glance at their starting hand through the eyes of a spider hanging from the wall, and in later games, continuous looks at their changing cards. Still, he didn't win every game, but he took most, and many easily. It earned him many nulla, too, of all stripes and shapes, a small cask of home-brewed beer, a wavy-bladed dagger, labor from carvers of wood and stone, which he promptly turned in for more figures for his expanding Nulladoon set. But victory robbed him. When his opponents clicked their pieces into their wooden boxes, frustration or sad self-disappointment creasing their bearded faces, he had to turn away, a risk blurting his deception. When Norrin recognized his face, called him by name, and bought him drinks and meals, his stomach turned with inward disgust. He had to end it. 2 weeks from the night Morn had won their first match, he issued his challenge. He had no doubt Waring knew his motives, or at least what he would ask if he won. But denying a public challenge was a disgrace, one that could lessen the perceived value of the denier's crafts or skills. Were they afraid they made unworthy gifts? And thus the social standing of the denier themselves. Waring accepted. She set a date for Wednesday night, 3 days hence.
"What happens if you lose?" Morn asked that night.
They'd headed upstairs to Dante's room to unwind and go over the ins and outs of Waring's standard strategy. Pieces and cards littered the board, scattered between chipped beer mugs. Dante shrugged. "Convince her to see reason?"
"She won't."
"Then I'll keep coming back."
"She won't see you," Morn said.
"Then I'll make myself look very, very scary." Dante lifted his palms.
"What do you want me to say? Maybe there won't be anything I can do." "Well, I just wanted to know if you'd considered that possibility. I think it's an important one for everyone to spend some time thinking about."
The Norrin knocked an unpainted wooden archer on its side.
"Lots of time, to be quite frank. It's always less disappointing that way."
"What's your Nulla, anyway?" Belay said from his seat in the window. Morn glanced over.
"What?"
"Your Nulla. You all have one, right? So what's yours?"
"Oh."
Morn cupped his hands together, forming a box, then peeked inside, as if expecting to find the answer.
"Well."
Dante frowned. "I thought you guys start in on your calling before you learn how to shake a rattle."
"The thing is, the quality of my work doesn't yet match up to my personal standards."
"Oh, come on."
Blaze shoved off the windowsill and refilled his mug from a pitcher on the table. Foam spattered the board. Morn scowled and toweled it up with his sleeve. Blaze took a long swig, foam mustaching his lip. "We're all friends here. If I'm going to mock your lack of skills, it'll be to your face." The Norrin rubbed his beard.
"Arrowheads."
"Fletching? Well, that's great. Nothing badder than a man who makes his own weapons." Morn shook his head.
"Just arrowheads. There's a lot to them, you know. For instance, you humans favor metalheads exclusively. But obsidian arrowheads are frightening. Sharp as a razor, but they'll break off inside your gut if you try to pull them out the wrong way. On the other hand, rock isn't what you'd call malleable. And I, for one, think the entire arrowhead industry is conservative to the point of absurdity. Why are we so locked into the triangle? What about a crescent shape? Much better for attempting to sever distant ropes, I say. And what if you shape them so they whistle in flight? There'll be no need to carry a bulky old horn into the battlefield."
Blaze nodded thoughtfully. "I'd make my Nulla sex." Morn reddened beneath his beard.
"It doesn't work that way."
"It can be anything, can't it?"
"It has to be something tangible, something you can hold."
"Oh, there'd be something to hold." Morn snatched his mug from the table.
"It can't just be an experience. Other people have to be able to see it."
"What about poems?" Dante said. "What about them? You can write them down, can't you?"
"That seems like a cheat. Most poems are recited."
I don't see what's cheating about it. What if I give you a drawing afterwards? Blaze said. Morn glared into his beer.
You're not taking this seriously.
How about dancers? Dante said. You said dancers could be nulla.
Those are public. Other people can see and confirm the value of what you're receiving.
Look, Blaze said, if I've dedicated my whole life to sex, I think I'll be good enough at it that it'll be no issue to throw a sheet across the plaza and...
I don't think they would appreciate a solo performance, Dante said.
Morn rose, swaying.
I'm going to bed.
3 days came and went like the boats at the piers. It was time. Warring didn't care about the venue, so Dante had arranged to hold it in the pub where he'd learned to play. He was comfortable there. And the playing stations lined the back wall, providing ready purchase for a spying spider. Warring arrived alone, seating herself opposite Dante. The crowd closed in behind her, pointing at specific positions on the table despite the fact that not a single tile had been laid. Warring withdrew a glossy teak box from a purple velvet sack. The case's latches snicked. She arranged her pieces, soapstone warriors and beasts dressed in minutely sewn clothing, leather armor, cotton trousers, and brown boots laced with single lengths of thread. Finished, she gazed at him over the table.
I hear you're among the best human players of your generation.
He shrugged, stacking tiles with wooden clicks. When the right cause inspires me, I'll see it through, at any cost.
What cause led you to pushing toy soldiers around a fake map?
One of those casual injustices that has been going on for so long that speaking about it in polite company brands you a fanatic.
Ah, that narrows it down.
They agreed on a map. Lake Patch, a common terrain where many ponds funneled action into the killing fields of open meadows. Peace allotment. Standard 3, a skirmisher-heavy default, which they modified with an allowance to swap out any 2 units. And the terms of the nulla.
A tapestry, he said. Choice of subject decided by me.
Her brown eyes met his.
It said you're a healer.
Once you cause enough wounds, you get a pretty good idea how to fix them.
My father was enslaved for debt a few years into my apprenticeship. They worked him in the fields. One day they were short of oxen, so they made him pull the plough. He tripped in a gopher hole and broke his leg.
She laid her first tile, holding his gaze. They didn't bother to set it. He still can't walk.
Old wounds are harder work, he said, but if I can, I will.
The arbiters, to reduce the risk of rogue decisions stripping him of victory, Dante had insisted on 3 of them, introduced themselves and sat. The audience placed bets of drinks and money, and sometimes small nulla of their own. Mostly, they watched with open grins as the final piece was placed and Warring opened, drakes zagging along one side of the board, while her archers and gnomes ducked in and out of cover. Dante advanced to intercept, his forces aligned in a shifting sickle, striking from both points of the blade as Warring rearranged her defenses from one side of the field to the other. She gave a small smile.
You fight like a human.
What does that mean?
I have no damn idea what you think you're doing.
He smiled back, then played a run of cards. By the time he completed the side game, he'd depleted twice as many of her cards as he'd spent, snagging a crucial modifier to his sorcerer's armor. The figure was a tentpole of his strategy, obliterating anything that came too close, yet it had already been bloodied to dangerous levels by the regular pelting of her archers, who fired behind the safety of lakes, clad in nothing stronger than their brown cotton robes.
Take a break, he said an hour later.
Their forces were on the verge of a critical, all-out melee. For the last several moves, her gnomes had harried his Norrin frontliners, dancing forward to the very point of overextension, before drawing back into the protective range of her archers. He'd withdrawn his sorcerer early on to preserve it as he maneuvered his bear cavalry to block those damned gnomes. Recognizing his ploy, she'd arranged her troops into jagged yet subtly intricate lines of defense that